This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
We're very delighted tonight to be launching this wonderful book. I think before I give any introduction, I'd just like to break the wonderful news that the book that we're launching tonight, Israel, A Concise History, by Rabbi Dr. Danny Gordis, has today been announced that it has won the 216 National Jewish Book Award. This is quite something. And as the circular said, it said the book was selected after careful analysis, and it was selected as the best written, most comprehensive, and engaging book of the year. And they write that this is a new history of Israel that should become a standard for years to come, perhaps even a classic. So that's quite an accolade, and we want to wish you Mazal Tov. And we're very delighted in your success and this accolade. It's really amazing. And I've got to say, now I'm even more looking forward to reading the book, knowing that this is going to become the standard. Let me just begin with some words of introduction. We are, some peoples, maybe the Greeks, begin with the great philosophers. We, the Jewish people, our Torah is a book of stories. And maybe we can even say that God is the first storyteller. He tells us our philosophy, our values, our passions, our propensity to make mistakes in the form of stories. And I will say that the first book that I read of Danny Gordis's was actually a philosophy book, God Was Not in the Fire. But I think he's become better known in the Jewish world through telling his story. I think it began, certainly if we're talking about a history of Israel, with the dispatches that he sent out when he first came here. I think it was on a sabbatical when he first came. And through the experiences of the Intifada, which later were collated into a book. And then this developed where you became, I think, one of the leading advocates for Israel on the international stage, where Israel is frequently beleaguered both from without and sometimes also from within. And I think you work to fight on both of those different fronts. I seem to remember that the last book you launched here was a biography of Menachem Begin. And this is our speaker tonight is not just a man who writes and tells stories, but also somebody who is actively working in the field in Shalem College to create a new type of education in Israel and to raise a whole new class of students who will have a different type of education, but an education that Shalem College is hoping will impact the Israeli society, and if I could go maybe a stage further, the leadership of the State of Israel. And we certainly do hope we need leadership, and we do hope they will be successful in every way in that endeavor. And so when I see that Danny Gordis has set his mind to write a concise history of Israel, very concise, just 560 pages, we've got a lot of history to tell and a lot of stories to tell. But as we all know, we are in an era in which we don't just talk about history, we talk about narratives. And then the question is, which stories do you choose to tell? And how do you decide to tell them? Because, of course, what you choose and the way you tell the story is going to make all the difference. And I think, as I said before, both to people outside the Jewish fold, but also within the Jewish people, as the sea changes affect the ebb and tide of how people relate to Israel, we are really, really in need for people who are able to communicate Israel's story. And I think that's what we've come to hear about tonight. So I'd like to invite our speaker, Rabbi Dr. Daniel Gordis. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much, Alex, for the gracious introduction. And thanks to Pardes, really, for the gracious willingness to launch the books periodically here. This Beit Midrash is actually a kind of a very, very special place to our family. Just a number of weeks after we got here, supposedly for a year in 1998, we actually had our daughter's bat mitzvah right in this room because we didn't have another shul yet that we were really going to. And this was before the days of Shirah Hadashah and Sion and the Shivyoni. And so this was the only place where you could actually do the kinds of horrific things that now take place all across Jerusalem and probably even in this Beit Midrash itself. But back in the day, Pardes was lovely enough to allow us to have the bat mitzvah here. And ever since then, I think most of the books, or at least in recent years, I've had the honor and the privilege of launching them in Israel from this place. And so I'm really very grateful for your continued friendship and for Pardes' continued hospitality. I'll say a brief word about a little bit about the book in just a minute. But I just want to begin, actually, by, I don't think they're here yet, but Allie and Rachel. So I'm going to wait until they get here. I'll say something about them. But the people that helped me with the book are actually supposedly going to come later tonight, so we'll see about that. So I'm going to start actually then with something very different. It's something about why the book begins where the book begins and why does the book end where the book ends. When you want to tell a story about Israel, those are two very natural questions. Everybody asks, where do you start it? Well, the one obvious wrong place, of course, is 1948. I mean, that it's obvious that wherever you're going to start at 1948 is definitely the wrong time. Because by 1948, things are well underway. And a lot of people actually, some of the reviews have gone, 40% of the book is actually done before he gets to 1948. Well, yeah, it's not my fault that Herzl came, 50 years before 1947 or whatever. But so part of the question is, where do you start it? And another interesting question, of course, is where do you end it? So I want to say something about why I chose to start it where I chose to start it and why I chose to end it where I chose to end it. And that will actually allow me to go back to what Alex was very kind enough to say a little bit before, which is about some of the other previous books that I had occasion to write about Israel since we've lived here. Somebody asked me a really interesting question about a month ago. Everybody asks, where'd you get the idea to write the book? That's an easy question, and I'll give you the answer in a second. But somebody asked me, I thought, a much more interesting question a few weeks ago. And he said, could you have written this book 10 years ago? I thought that was a very interesting question. So what got me to write the book? It's very simple. Many of you know Barry Schrag, who is the head of the Combined Jewish Philanthropies, the CJP in Boston. Barry's a good friend. I was literally just finishing up the Menachem Begin book, wondering what am I going to do next with my life, but not worried about it too much because there was still Begin work to do. And Barry Schrag, I guess, emailed me. Nobody calls anybody anymore. And he said, I'm bringing a group of people to Israel, and I want to give them a single-volume history of the state. It has to be readable. It has to be academically defensible. Wouldn't be bad if it was a little bit, inspiring, and it can't be a long tome. I can't find anything. What do you suggest? So I said, well, there's definitely something out there. I can't look at it right now. At the end of the day, I'll whatever. So, of course, we all do the same thing. We have these $1,000 of computer equipment on our table, but we make like a little one-cent yellow stick-em thing and plug it onto the monitor and say, deal with Barry later. And at the end of the day, I went on my shelf, and I'm looking, and there's a lot of really great ones. There's Howard Sacker's. That appeared in 1976. It's been subsequently updated, but it appeared in 1976, and it's 1,200 pages. Now, for a generation that believes that life's most intimate sentiments can be expressed in 140 characters, 1,200 pages is a lot of tweets. So even for the incoming president, I would say 1,200 pages is a lot of tweets. But, he'll have 4 years. We'll see. But so that was too long. Then there was... There's been a lot of Martin Gilbert wrote an excellent one that came out about 2000, an excellent book. But number one, he's British. And the British ear and the American ear are really slightly different. People are asking different kinds of questions about Israel, and they're bringing different kinds of assumptions about Israel to the table. And, of course, a lot has changed between the year 2000 and the year 2014 or so when I started to write the book. Then there's, of course, Anita Shapira's book, imaginatively entitled, like mine, Israel. And... hers is also excellent. It's long. It's about 240,000 words. Now, I tried to do a word count on the Kindle version. In fact, I bought the Kindle version only for the purpose of the word count, only to discover that in some Kindle versions you can count the words and in others you can't. So what I did was I Xeroxed about 20 random pages out of Anita Shapira's book, and then during a really laborious faculty meeting, I'm sure that here they're much more compelling and nobody would do this. But at Shalem, periodically, most of the meetings are gripping. But periodically, you know, you sort of, you count off five words, make a little hash mark, count another five words, and you do this on 20 different pages. You take the average. You figure that's the average words per page. Then you multiply it by the number of pages. I'm quite confident that it's somewhere around 240,000 words. That's also a long slog. They made the margins very narrow. They made the print somewhat smaller. So it doesn't look as big, but it's also a very long book. So I was actually surprised when Barry wrote there was nothing actually out there. And so I thought, okay, I'll do that. That could actually be fun. So that's the question of sort of why do the book at all? Barry wrote this idea. I was looking for something to do. But I really think that this other person's question is really much more interesting. Could I have written the book 10 years ago? And I think there the answer actually is no. And I'll tell you why. Many of us in this room live here. And many of us in the room have lived here for a number of years. And we know that there's a kind of a process to living here. And at the beginning, what you do is you notice all the really cool stuff, right? You notice that on Rosh Hashanah, you walk 10 minutes to shul, you pass 15 other shuls you would never step foot into, you hear shofar blowing in each one of them, because they started davening ridiculously early, and you're kind of taken aback by, that's really unbelievably cool. Or your son comes home from the army and tells you that he's out in the Negev in Purim, and he's not, you know, whatever it is, and a Jeep swoops by out of the middle of nowhere and says, who needs to hear Megillah reading? And the people who raise their hand get put on the Jeep, driven to some yeshuv someplace, they hear Megillah, and then they get dumped right back in the Negev to do whatever they were doing before, and you think to yourself, that's really cool. Or many of the other things that many of us in this room have had the experience of having, there's just those moments when you say, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore. Something has happened here that's really different. And I think for many of us, that first phase of living in Israel is just all those nekudati, specific kinds of things that are just really wonderful and heartwarming and sometimes even give you a little bit of a shiver. But that's not a book. Well, in my case, actually kind of was a book. But so I wrote those dispatches and, you know, want to thank our neighbors all around us for making 2000 and 2004 a very interesting period around here. So I started to write these kind of what's it like to live in Jerusalem during this thing, and then they kind of got grouped together. So the first phase was really kind of just telling stories about Yerushalayim and telling stories about Israel from the point of view, three little kids, what's it like to live here, having left a neighborhood where the most exciting thing that ever happened was when the gardener got a new weed whacker, and now literally things were a little bit more interesting than that. And that was a kind of a certain phase of sort of telling stories. Then you stop that because your daughter actually starts going out on dates and you make the mistake of mentioning it once in a dispatch and she has a little talk with you. And she subsequently became a lawyer, so you can just imagine what that talk was like. But she earned it back. She's the mother of my granddaughter, so it's all forgiven. And you realize, okay, those days of the storytelling, those are done. And then you try to ask yourself, at least I try to ask myself, what are we really doing here? Like what's, you know, how do you justify Israel as a democracy, which is a Jewish democracy, not an American kind of democracy? And I wrote a couple of books. One was Saving Israel, and one was The Promise of Israel, kind of more theoretical takes on whatever. Then, but I think if you've been here long enough, then all the kind of really, well, that's cool, and that's cool, that kind of subsides. And we each make our own peace with however we justify this kind of a place and this kind of a setting and this kind of a region, and that subsides. And then, like with anything in life, when something happens to us, you know, 1 month ago, we have a certain take on it. When it happens 5 years ago, we have a different take. And then 20 years later, we have a very, very different take on what that something is. And we've been here exactly 20 years, or almost 20 years. And I think now at this point, there's a kind of a certain perspective. And I was able to ask myself, what's this story about? What's the story that we are telling when we tell the story of the state of Israel? And more importantly, especially given the fact that the conversation about Israel, even, by the way, I would imagine among many of the students who study here, but certainly all across America, has become entirely what I would call conflict-centric. It's about the conflict. Every single Shabbos table, it's about the conflict in some way, shape, manner, or form. Obama versus Trump, or Hezbollah or Hamas, or settlements or occupation, or Iran, or UN. I mean, it's always something like that, which it seems to me says nothing about Israel. Just says nothing about Israel. Imagine somebody comes and says to you, tell me about the United States of America. Right? And you say, well, there was a war in 1776. I'm going to skip a few. There was a war in 1812. There was a war in the Civil War in 62 to 65. There was a First World War. There was a Second World War. There was a Korean War. There was a Vietnam War. There was an Iraq War. There was an Afghanistan War. Isn't America a great place? And you'd actually, of course, have sold America entirely short, because in order to talk about what makes America great, you got to look at the Declaration of Independence. And then you got to look at Thomas Jefferson's penultimate letter, his last public letter and his next to last letter at all, that he wrote a few weeks before he died, exactly 50 years to the date after July 4th, 1776, explaining to his colleagues in Washington why he was not going to be able to go to Washington for the celebration. He was just too old and too frail and too sick. Little did he know he wouldn't live more than a few more weeks. But he then writes a letter explaining what he thought the Declaration of Independence had done, not for the colonies and then for America, but what it had done for the West, what it had done for the free world, what it had done for democracy. If you want to know America, you got to read the Federalist Papers. If you want to know America, you got to read Lincoln, and not the Gettysburg Address, which is very moving and powerful but doesn't really say much about anything, but actually something like the Lyceum Address, which is commonly called the Address on the Perpetuation of Our Institutions, in which he speaks as a young man long before he runs for president about the danger of the mob and the danger that it poses to America's democracy. Little did he know what he was going to encounter as president a number of years later. You got to read Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, right? And by the way, it's worth pointing out that Martin Luther King's letter to the Birmingham from the Birmingham jail we have because he wrote it in the margins of newspapers, ripped off the margin, crumpled it up, and then surreptitiously passed it off to people who then took it out, and then people kind of unraveled them and strung them together and re-put it together because he wasn't allowed to write in jail. And it's important to remember that Martin Luther King was in jail not in China or in North Korea. Right? He was in jail in the United States of America, and not 200 years ago. He was in jail in North America, in the United States of America, in the lifetime of many of the people sitting in this room. In fact, most of the people sitting in this room. And he wasn't allowed to write? It's just an important corrective to this sense that decent countries are always decent. Thoroughly decent countries all have their blemishes. But if you want to know what America's about, you got to go to the Federalist Papers, you got to go to the Declaration of Independence, you got to read Lincoln, you got to read Martin Luther King, you got to read a whole bunch of those things. I would say even Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book, Between the World and Me, Between the World and You or Me, I forget which one it is. Those are the kinds of things that you need to be able to say that you've read in order to talk about what makes America great. And it seemed to me that a story about Israel should focus not on the wars. You got to talk about the wars, but you should really talk about the soul. Why did the Jewish people want to come back to this place? What made them move from dreaming about coming back to this place? Shabbat morning, Matay Timloch B'Tzion, B'Karov B'Yamenu Le'olam Ba'ed Tishkon, or V'Havayenu L'Shalom Me'arbak Anfot Ha'aretz, or Uvnei Yerushalayim Ira Kodesh Me'arav V'Yamenu, whatever the case may be, why do they move from doing that to actually getting on boats and draining swamps? And I wanted to tell the story both for why we came back, when we came back. And although, yes, of course, the war has to be talked about, the wars have to be talked about, to try to see if we could get into the kishkas of people by talking about the things we don't talk about anymore, like Chaim Nachman Bialik, like Natan Alterman, like David Grossman, like Lahavdil El Alfa Fei Avdolot Shtisel, or, Srugim, or, the book came out too early, but Fauda now would have been a good example, right? If you haven't seen Srugim, it's somewhere on the television food chain, I would say, between As the World Turns and The Good Wife, right? Meaning, it's not absolute trash, doesn't have the budget that The Good Wife had, but it's a fascinating portrayal of young, unmarried, religious people up on Rehovot Palmach, desperately trying to find their bashert, some becoming religious in order to find one, some becoming non-religious in order to find one, some making the horrendous mistake of actually getting married, thinking that that's going to make you happy. In any event, I wanted to try to get into the kishkas of Israel. So to go back, where do you start the story and where do you end the story? I want to start the story in two places. You have to start the story, it seems to me, in 1896 or 1897 with the writing of the Jewish state and then the first Zionist Congress. Because Zionism is one thing when the Jews are dreaming about the state, but Zionism is another thing altogether when the Jews are actually actively engaged in trying to build the state. And the flipping of Zionism from a kind of an ethereal yearning for Zion to Zionism as a political movement, of course, is 1896, 1897. That's where it all starts. Herzl publishes the Jewish state in 1896. The first Zionist Congress follows less than a year later in 1897. And it's the first time in 2,000 years that the Jewish people have ever, as a people from all over the world, gotten together to do anything. We don't think about it that way. But there were Jews in North Africa, there were Jews in Yemen, there were Jews in Eastern Europe, there were Jews in Western Europe, there were Jews in Italy, there were Jews all over the world, and for 2,000 years they kind of lived as clusters. Did they know about each other? Yes. Did they sometimes write to rabbinic authorities across the ocean to get answers to Shaylot? Yes. But fundamentally, did the Jews of Ashkenaz and the Jews of Yemen ever do anything together in a meaningful way? Absolutely not. Part of it was distance, but part of it was just no shared agenda other than living life in a certain kind of a way. 1897 changes that. 1897, in a certain way, marks the rebirth of Jewish peoplehood. Because all of a sudden, the Jews of Austria and the Jews of France and the Jews of the United States and the Jews of Italy and the Jews of North Africa have a project together. I mean, in that regard, Jewish peoplehood really comes back to life in 1897 in that conference hall in Basel. And that's why I thought the story really should start more or less there. The problem with starting the story there, is, of course, that you can let people fall into the trap of thinking that what Zionism is simply the Jewish version of late 19th century nationalism. So Europe is breaking out across the world with nationalism. By the way, and those nationalisms are, derech agav, going to also lead to the First World War. So not only are you sort of just like everybody else, but you're part of a curse like everybody else. And in that way, kind of, it just kind of dooms the Zionist narrative even before it gets started. So I decided that I would start in 1897, but then very quickly move back 2,000 years. And then talk about, Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimaladetcha el beita, mi'beit avicha el ha'aretz asher arecha, to like this place, right? The first thing that God says to the first Jew, go to this place. And the last thing that anybody says in the Tanakh at all is Koresh saying to the Jews, Hashem imo v'ya'al. Right? The last call for aliyah in the Torah is from Koresh, the non-Jew. Okay. But the book of Genesis, more or less, by chapter 12, already opens up with going to this place. The end of the Tanakh, the very, very end of the Divrei HaYamim Bet, ends with going to this place. And of course, for those of us that know traditional Jewish life, it kind of goes without saying, but it's not true for everybody. Not everybody knows it. Birkat HaMazon, right? If you're sitting in Florida and you're eating bread made out of wheat grown in Iowa, still the only place that you mention is Yerushalayim. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. I don't know if you fly El Al periodically. They have on the screen, the arrow shows you the direction of Yerushalayim, right? So that when the people get up to block everybody in the aisles, they know exactly which direction to turn, right? God forbid you should be in the aisle blocking everybody facing slightly 3 degrees off. So the arrow actually points you. I've always thought it very funny, by the way, that El Al both pleads with you not to do that davening in the plane and then puts the arrow on the screen. You know, no smoking, here's an ashtray kind of thing. But whatever, it's El Al. So we know that. I mean, no matter where you are, you're davening towards Yerushalayim. No matter what you believe and what your politics are, on Shabbat morning you're saying Matai Timloch B'Tzion. Before the Shema, you're saying V'Havagenu L'Shalom E'Abakanfot Ha'aretz. Those are not political statements. Those are not left-wing, right-wing statements. They're not religious, secular statements. They're simply part of a Jewish dream. So I thought that at the second chapter, you ought to go back to Avraham, trace through very quickly biblical history, show, by the way, the danger of division, because that's going to come up later in Israel history. But you got to show that as soon as the kingdom splits, it's over. You got to show the very, very dangerous mistake of making serious foreign policy mistakes, which both kings make and the Maccabees may make, and certainly Bar Kokhba makes, and so on and so forth, to try to set antecedents. And then you could ask, well, why not go in order? Right? Why not then start with Tanakh and Avraham and then go to Herzl? And a very simple reason. You ever been in Barnes & Noble? Ever picked up a book on the table and opened it up to the first chapter and started to read and decide if you want to buy the book or not buy the book? That's why. Because anybody that picked up the book opened up chapter 1 and says, well, Abraham, forget it. Like, I wanted to start with something having to do with tanks, you know. So it's a long way between Abraham and tanks. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, they don't get a lot of tanks in this book, but they get some, because it's hard to tell a story without tanks at all. But so I decided to start with the beginning of the Zionist movement, then move all the way back, and then to tell the story as it rolls through. Now, the question, of course, is then, where do you stop? And the danger always is, of course, that the minute you stop, the book comes out, something major is going to happen, and then, you know, you're kind of done. So thank God nothing has changed in the Jewish world in the last, you know, 9 months since the book was finished. Everything has stayed exactly the same. There's been no political shifts. There have been no appointments that are of any note. So everything is kind of quiet, Baruch Hashem. But hypothetically, it could have been that things would have actually not been so clear. So the best way to avoid that problem is not to end with anything chronological. Because even though you've told the story until the point, if it's not in the last chapter, it doesn't give the impression and they all lived happily ever after, or they all kind of tortured each other happily ever after, right? Neither of those things. So the last chapter in the book actually talks about the rebirth of Judaism in the Jewish state. And I'm going to come back to that in just 1 second. But think about it. There's a whole long process in this relationship between the Jewish state and the Jewish tradition. It's kind of a relationship that has its ups and its downs, and it matures over the course of time. And in large measure, by the way, that's what the book is about. In other words, if somebody finishes the book and somebody else says to them, so what's Israel all about? What I would love for them to say is, they don't say this, but what I would love for them to say is, Israel is the place where the Jewish people went to reimagine what Jewish people should be about. It's not the place where we went to fight the Palestinians. And it's not the place where we went to have an army. And it's not the place that we went to have, you know, a raucousy Knesset. We have a raucousy Knesset because it's the place that we came back to try to figure out what should Jewish peoplehood mean, first in the 20th century and now in the 21st century. That, in effect, by the way, is what Zionism always was until the Shoah. I mean, in those years before the Shoah, with Herzl and Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion and Berdichevsky, and you go on and on and on. All those people, by the way, that make up Arthur Hertzberg's book, The Zionist Idea, which everybody claims to have read and nobody has actually ever read, right? You know that if you say you read it, you know you're lying. So don't say it, because the people that you're saying it to know you're lying also. And then you say, well, I read the introduction. No, you didn't. It's 150 pages of an introduction. You didn't read it. You thought about reading it. And then you started reading it. But don't lie, you didn't read it. Okay, but anyway, all those people that make up Arthur Hertzberg's, it's a fantastic book, and Gil Troy's actually now doing a revised version of it. I'm just going to go out on a wild guess here, and see if the introduction maybe less than 150 pages. I don't know, but I'm going to go out on a wild guess here. That's a conversation. What's the relationship between this thing that we're imagining one day we're going to have and the Jewish tradition be? Should it be secular? Should it be religious? By the time Kishinev comes around and Bialik writes Be'er HaRega and says basically that Jews got slaughtered in Kishinev because they were so busy shuckling over Gemaras that they didn't know how to defend themselves, and they were weak and they were cowardly and they were even inhuman, because he has this horrible scene where the Kohanim run and ask the rabbi if their wives are still permitted to them. I mean, it's a horrible thing, probably never happened, but he's trying to make a point. From the declaration of war against the Jewish tradition in Zionism to, let's say, 2015, when Shtisel, I mean, this is 100% serious. When Shtisel, which is a soap opera about Haredim, a very kind of loving, embracing soap opera about Haredim, becomes for a while the number one Israeli television show, and don't forget, the Haredim aren't watching it, right? So how does it say, or most of them are not, right? How do you explain the fact that a country that is angry at them because they don't go to the army, that feels that they're parasitic, many people feel, because they're not participating in the economic future of the country, how does a show about them that's so loving then become a number one show? And it's because people want to know what's the magic. Why in 2014 do families choose to have 12 children? Seriously, why do they choose to do that? And why do they choose to consign themselves and their children to what most of us in this room would call poverty? They may not call it that, but most of us in this room would. Why do people do that? And Israelis kind of curious, because, you know, I work in Tel Aviv, not me, but I, the Israeli, work in Tel Aviv in that steel and glass tower, and it's all good. And it doesn't feel as full as what they seem to have. What do they have? I want to know. Seems to me that between Chaim Nachman Bialik writing in 1904 and declaring war on the Jewish tradition, and 2014, more or less, 110 years later, Israeli society embracing a show like Shtisel is actually kind of the meandering of a relationship. So let's trace the relationship just a little bit, and then I'll wrap it up, and then we'll open up for this discussion. Everybody's seen the big picture of David Ben-Gurion under the portrait of Herzl, right? The hair. It actually wasn't as bad then as it got eventually, but right, he's got the hair thing going on, then there's people sitting at the dais, big Israeli flags, Anu Machrizim Bazot, which I will not try to imitate. He's not wearing a kippah. He's not. And this was not, oh my God, I forgot a kippah. Does anybody have a kippah? Nobody has a kippah. It's Erev Shabbat. What are we going to do? Let's just go anyway. That was not exactly that, right? There is a kind of secularism in Israel, which is the direct descendant of Bialik, and it's a direct descendant of Nathan Alterman, who writes in 47, at the end of 47, when he writes Magasha Kesef, the silver platter, in which the Jewish state replaces Sinai as that which the entire Jewish people is arrayed to welcome, and that's going to change the world. There is that early generation of Zionists that were really about a declaration of war in the Jewish tradition. Why did all those Jews change their names? Why did David Gruen become David Ben-Gurion? And why did Shimon Persky become Shimon Peretz? And why did Golda Meirson become Golda Meir? And on and on and on. Partly it was the law, in the sense that if you wanted to move up in Ben-Gurion's government, you had to change your name. It wasn't a law, but it was a de facto law in the Labor Party. If you wanted to move up, you simply had to change your name. Now, why? Because it would be cuter if when you had your little Kova Tembel and short shorts, you also had an Israeli name? No. Because if you had a European name, you hadn't rebelled enough against the Judaism that had ossified us for 2,000 years. If you could still have your old name, you didn't understand what European Judaism had done to us. If you were still willing to be your father's son, if you were willing to be your mother's daughter and have their name, you didn't get it. And you weren't a player. That's why they changed their names. To move up into the government, that's true. But to say, my father is not my father. My family is not my family. The yeshiva is not my home. My new home is the Galil. Right? And, Shlonsky will write a poem called Amal. Avraham Shlonsky will write it, but I don't think it's in the book. Is it in the book? No. There's a poem called Amal by Shlonsky when he talks about saying to his mother, Im Shacharit, with morning, take me to. Now, where does a Jew say to his mother, take me to when it's Shacharit time? Take me to work, he says. And we're going to build buildings, batim, which are the batim of the tefillin. And he says, and we're going to work on long black stripes, which are the roads of the Galilee. In other words, he's saying there used to be tefillin, now there's houses and roads. The entire Galil, he says, is wrapped, lehit atef, he uses, is wrapped in sunlight. You guys used to wrap yourselves in a talit, we wrap ourselves in sunlight. So there was this early period of kind of really viciously anti-Jewish, anti-religious period of Zionism, which is everybody had this phrase, you know, Tanakh Palmach, anything that came after the Tanakh, before the Palmach being the strike force of the Haganah, nothing was in there. And if you went to kibbutzim in the 1950s and the 1960s that were secular kibbutzim, you would see no Gemaras. You'd see a Tanakh. But there was no Gemara, there was no Yehuda HaLevi, there was no Shlomo Ibn Gvirol, there was no Machzer, there was no Sidur, and it wasn't because of a budget problem. It was because anything post-Tanakh was exilic. And anything exilic was by definition mashpil. It kind of, subordinated you. It was not dignified. And this is a period that goes on for a very, very long time. What's a way of telling how deeply how deeply formative of Israel was this hyper-secularist narrative? The kibbutzim at their max were 6% of the Jewish population here. Nobody thinks about that because everybody was in a kibbutz, right? We have a friend that actually came over a few years ago. And she said to us, well, so many of you are farmers. And my son's eyes literally almost popped out of his head. And I'm going to have to clean this up a little bit. But he said after she left, she thinks we go to school on a camel. Now, it was a little spicier, but nonetheless, on a certain kind of camel. But only 6% of us rode to school on camels. Actually, 0% of us did. Only 6%, but if you look at the 1960s and you look at people who were in officers' training school and people who were officers in Tzahal, it was 30-something percent came from the kibbutzim. And if you look at the casualties in Tzahal in the 1960s, during the Six-Day War, but in other operations also, between 30 and 40% were from the kibbutzim, even though the kibbutzim were really only 6% of the population. The kibbutz was the laboratory for Zionist passion. The kibbutz was the laboratory of Zionist ideology. And in many respects, that reaches its culmination in 1967. Because in 1967 is really the first time that the Jews breathed deeply. 1949 didn't bring that about. There were no peace deals. There were only armistice lines. There was no cessation of the conflict. There were tens of thousands of border incursions a year. That's not a misstatement. There were tens of thousands of border incursions a year in the 1950s. Now, a lot of it, by the way, was Arabs coming back to work the lands that they claimed were still their farms. And a lot of it wasn't. People were killed, buses were shot up, farms were burned, etc. The 1960s, and especially 67, is the first time that Jews actually take a break. Take a deep breath, and have a sense that the new Jew has really been born. This notion of the new Jew, right? The Jew not in the yeshiva, but the Jew of the plow and the rifle. The Jew who's not hunched over, but the Jew who's bronzed and muscular. You know all those old posters, right? With these bronzed Jews that look nothing like those Rembrandt pictures. It's important to note the difference. Rembrandt had one idealized vision of the Jew, and those posters had a very different idealized vision of the Jew. That really comes to fruition in 1967. And I think the best way to describe how radically transformative Israel was of the existential condition of the Jew is to think of 22 years. Most of the people, not all, but most of the people in this room are old enough to know that 22 years is a blink in time. Right? Most people in this room are actually wondering where the last 22 years went. Right? Like, I was doing exactly the same thing 22 years ago. What happened? Okay. January 1945 is the liberation of Auschwitz. Russian troops liberate Auschwitz. Many of those people are going to die because the Russian soldiers are going to feed them. Just out of the goodness of their heart, they're going to take their rations, they're going to give them food, and they're going to unwittingly kill them because their bodies can't digest food. I mean, the people that straggle out of Auschwitz in January 1945 wearing those unbelievably baggy things because they were not made for skeletons, they were made for people. It's the ultimate image of utter victimhood. And 22 years later and a few months is June 67, when paratroopers burst through the Lion's Gate, take East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Golan, Gaza, and Sinai, and triple Israel's size in 6 days. The extraordinary transformation of the Jewish people and the Jewish sense of self in a mere 22 years is really unbelievable. Part of our problem today, by the way, especially with the younger generation, is that the transformation is so utterly complete that people can't imagine, young people today, what it was like to be a Jew before this transformation. They don't understand that in Cincinnati and Los Angeles and in Boston and Dallas and everywhere else, you carry yourself differently here, not because of 1948 or the vote in November 47. You carry yourself differently because of June 1967. But the transformation was so utterly complete that a Jew who's a teenager in 2017 can't even imagine what it used to be like. The Holocaust, literally, the beginning of the Holocaust, of the Shoah, is half as long ago as the end of the Civil War. Do the math. I mean, it's just literally dinosaur era as far as most people are concerned. And when they raise their children, there's going to be no survivors to meet. Right? If they take their children to Poland or their children go to Poland in high school, there's going to be no survivor to tell the story. It'll be videos. It'll be recordings. In other words, this is rapidly receding. So part of the problem that Israel faces today, actually, is the radical transformation of the Jewish condition from the victimhood of Kishinev, the victimhood of Auschwitz, to a hyper-secularism which seems to prove itself in 1967. Now, there's a crack in 67 because there's already a debate from the very, very early days. So now what do we do? So now everybody thinks, you know, territories, what to do, relatively new question. It's as old as the Six-Day War. Ben-Gurion's no longer prime minister, but he has all his marbles. He says, keep Jerusalem, because it's the eternal capital of the Jewish people. Keep the Golan, because enough of the settlements in the north, the kibbutzim, being shelled, and give the rest back. Ben-Gurion had refused to capture the West Bank in 49 when his generals wanted to, and he thought it was still a mistake in 67. He said, give it back. It's a huge mistake. So on the opposite side of the political spectrum, or at least the religious spectrum, did Yeshayahu Leibovitz, who was then Israel's leading public intellectual, say, give it back. Because if you keep it, it's going to corrode your soul. Okay, we find ourselves where we find ourselves because we didn't give it back, and it's easy to be a great chacham looking back and, you know, say, but if in 1967, most Israelis said, are you out of your mind? It's the first time we can breathe. And what we give it back, they're not going to attack again. After all, they went to Khartoum and they said, no peace, no recognition, no negotiations. We don't even have to guess what they want. So it's very easy in 2017, we should have, could have, whatever, wasn't so obvious in June 1967, even though people like Ben-Gurion and Leibovitz say there's a crack. My argument in the book, and one of the things that many people disagree with about the book, and they're wrong, is, they are. I mean, it would be wrong of me not to tell you. I argue in the book that 73 is a massive transformation in the psyche of the Israeli from which we're still recovering. A lot of people think that that's not true. 73 was a very long time ago. It's just not true. For example, look at television before Yom Kippur. How much of it is about Yom Kippur And how much of it is about Milchemet Yom HaKippurim? 90% of it is about Milchemet Yom HaKippurim. Every now and then on some little channel you get some rabbi saying something nice about something. It's the crack in everything. And it's the beginning of the realization that lots of kids can die and this Zionist thing doesn't fill your life with meaning in quite the way that you would hope that it would. So on Ein HaShita, which loses, I think, 12 boys in the war, Beit HaShita, which was, I think, 12 kids in the war. And there's these horrifying videos that you can see of the jeeps driving back into the kibbutz, one after the other, each one with a coffin in the back, draped with a flag. It's a lot for one simple kibbutz. And the next year, for the first time, they have a kol nidre on the kibbutz. Very interesting, with that very famous, Unutana Tokef, that was written the following year. There's a crack. And I argue in the book that that's actually the beginning of the end of the rebellion. It's the beginning of the end of the rebellion against Judaism. Now, it takes a long time to unfold. We don't have time tonight to go through all of it. But what I try to do later part of the book is to actually trace the rapprochement between Jews in Israel and the Jewish tradition. The Tanakh Palmach thing is gone. So that by the time we get to the last chapter, I actually cite, for example, Ruth Calderon, who became a member of the Knesset in the previous Knesset, and like every new member of the Knesset, gets up to give a speech, and her speech kind of went viral. It's on YouTube. You can find it. She carries a Gemara up to the plenum. Right? She turns to the Mr. Speaker, this religious guy with a big black kippah. He's sitting there. She's got the Gemara. It's kind of hilarious. And she says, "Mr. Speaker, when I met this book, I met the love of my life." And here's a completely secular woman discussing why she can't be a Jew without a Gemara. Now, we've come a very long way. And what I try to do mostly in the book is to trace the story of that renewed love affair, or the ending of the tantrum, the ending of the anger. And that's why it was important for me to start actually with Bialik, with El HaTzipor, with him by some figurative windowsill in Eastern Europe, talking to this bird that has just come from here. But El HaTzipor is filled with quotes from Tanakh. So even though he's never been here, Bialik, he can ask, "Does dew still fall like pearls on Mount Hermon?" How did he know that dew falls like pearls on Mount Hermon? He was never on a trek. Because the Tanakh told him. "Does God still have mercy on Zion?" He talks about this hill and this valley. How did he know all these places? Because he read the Tanakh. But by the time you get to 2014, 15, 16, Judaism is more than Tanakh. Ruth Calderon has taken a book back up to the plenum. Amos Oz and David Grossman are writing literature that is filled with references to Chazal and Tanakh. Agnon was all the time, but Agnon was a religious Jew. Now secular Jews are doing it too. If you read, for example, a much lesser known book and a newer book by Eshkol Nevo called Neuland, which is obviously a play on Alt-Neuland. He talks about these kids on a post-army trek who go on their trek to God only knows where, in this particular case to South America. And what do? They found a new Jewish state. Why would Jews do that? Why do Jews leaving Israel think they need Neuland, another new land? What's the heartbreak? Now, Neuland came out after I was finished with the book, or at least I only read it after I finished the book. But the point is that the book really tries to actually trace this story. The story of the Jews coming back to their home, the Jews trying to reimagine who and what they are. And therefore, the book really ends not with the wars, not with the conflict, not with Iran, although that's the last political thing that it talks about. But it really actually ends with things like Shtisel and things like Srugim and with Ruth Calderon. And what I hope, and I'll just stop with this in a sec, what I really hope the book will, at the end of the day, enable people to do, is to see Israel through a lens other than the lens of the conflict. Wherever we are, left, right, certain, uncertain, determined, exasperated, it doesn't really matter in the sense that none of us in this room are going to live to see the conflict resolved. I mean, I think deep down we know that. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't do some very smart things. We should. And it doesn't mean that there won't be deals made here and there. There probably will be. And it doesn't mean that borders might not get moved. They probably will. But to say that the conflict is going to get resolved in the lifetime of anybody, I mean, look at the world in which we live. In which part of the world does it look to you like it's heading towards resolution? The relationship between the Muslim world and the West. I mean, I say that tragically because we're all going to pay a price for that. Anybody who says that cavalierly just doesn't get it. Right? Anybody that says that cavalierly just didn't watch the news on Sunday. And you watch those four faces, and they're kids. They were kids, and what were they doing? They were standing on the toilet learning about Yerushalayim. I mean, so anybody that says, well, I don't care, we all have to care. But the care, it's not going to end. And therefore, it seems to me we as a Jewish people need to have a new way of thinking about Medinat Yisrael in a way in which the return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael is a story of something other than conflict. And I thought that Bialik and Alterman and Calderon and Amos Oz and so on and so forth was really fundamentally the way to do it. So it's a kind of a telling of Israel's story, both through political changes and through, of course, the conflict, but really trying to shed a light on its soul through the men and women who wrote in it, wrote about it, wrote for it, wrote with it, and I hope actually at the end of the day came to shape a little bit of what we will become. Take a drink for 1 second. And then I'll... So that was what the book tried to do, and you know, people ask what would be success for the book. So the publisher would say if every third person in India bought it, that would be really great. I guess that would be good. I'd probably retire. But much more important for me is if in 10 years, American kids on some campus someplace are having a conversation, and Israel's not only about the conflict, and in some way they understand that in order to talk about Israel, you need to know Bialik. You need to know Alterman. You need to know who Ben-Gurion was. You need to know that both David Ben-Gurion and Menachem Begin helped shape this country. And you need to know that both Achad Ha'am and Herzl helped shape this country. Herzl and Achad Ha'am both despised each other and disagreed with each other's ideas. And at the end of the day, both of their visions came to fruition. Ben-Gurion and Begin despised each other. In fact, Ben-Gurion tried to have Begin killed, it appears, during the Altalena. But at the end of the day, if it wasn't for Ben-Gurion, we would not have had the preparation necessary for having a state. And whereas other people, Bruce Hoffman and others, who's a well-known historian in the States, argue that it was Begin and the Irgun specifically that got the British to leave. And he actually argues that the coup de grace was the bombing of the King David Hotel, because that was the green zone. That was the green zone of Baghdad. It was the most protected place in all of Jerusalem. And if you could blow that up, every British mother understood that her son in Palestine was not safe anywhere. And that, he says, was the beginning of the end. So it's an attempt to try to tell the story in that way. And if, you know, students in America or students in Israel or wherever have a conversation about Israel that's a little bit different, a little bit more nuanced, in which Bialik is as much of a player as Yitzhak Rabin, and David Ben-Gurion and his machloket with Begin are as important as the machloket between Bennett and Netanyahu or all those kinds of issues, and they have a sense of the dramatic tapestry on which this thing has been written, to me that will have been a success. So I want to just end with what I was going to start with, but we didn't start with it, so I'll end with it. There's a few people in the room who were actually extremely helpful in working on the book, and I really want to do a hakarat hatov. So one of them is sitting over there, David Broomer, worked with us for a number of months on the history, and I'm very, very grateful. For two years, two people worked on the book, like, full-time, forever, night and day, Rachel Greenspan and Ali Mayer Feuerstein, who's sitting right back there. And I just want to say very quickly, there's all different kinds of research assistants. You know, there's research assistants who sort of, you know, look up stuff, check stuff, get permissions for photographs, and, you know, and go home. Then there's the kind of research assistant that you hand a chapter, you draft of a chapter, and you get it back, and four pages are completely crossed out. And you say, what's the deal? And I won't say which one says, well, that was the most boring thing I ever read. So I won't say which one of you that was, but you know that it was true. But more importantly, there's actually, it's a real bracha. It's really a huge zchut to work with people who are partners, not workers, who really argue about the way to understand something, the way to describe something, what's important, what's not important, and really actually with you try to figure out what is this story really all about. I mean, that's a huge, huge zchut. And the book would not be the book that, the book wouldn't be at all, by the way, but even if it had eventually gotten done, it would not be the book that it is without the moral and intellectual and Jewish insights of Rachel and Ali. All the three of us, I mean, what we have in common is we all were educated on the East Coast. We all made Aliyah. But in terms of our political positions and our religious places on the spectrum, we're all in very different places. And I think that actually made it for a much more rich and compelling ongoing chavruta. So this is the first time that the three of us have been in public together since the book came out. So it's really, for me, a long overdue opportunity to thank the two of you for being unbelievable partners. And I would say let's do it again sometime, but none of us are going to do that. So anyway, so I'm going to stop there, and happy to entertain some questions. Just remind you grammatically that questions end with a question mark, and they typically take the form of a sentence or two. But, you know, we'll do that for a few minutes, and then Alex, I guess, will give me a signal when everybody's about to commit suicide, and then we'll take it from there. Yeah. That's a great question. So first, I want to make one thing clear. When I say religious, I don't mean, you know, putting on talis and tefillin and doing negelwasser in the morning. I mean not being angry at the tradition and thinking that those texts matter. It's woven through. It's not like this chapter is about that and that chapter is about that. You know, there are other books where you can actually see one chapter is this, one chapter is that. This, I would like to think it's more woven through. So when you talk about the Yom Kippur War, yeah, it describes, you know, first the conflict in the south and then the conflict in the north and why Tzahal chose to fight first in the south and then fight in the north. It made certain critical decisions at a certain point in time. You know, it talks about Moshe Dayan, Golda Meir not letting Moshe Dayan get on the radio because, you know, he was going to talk about Churban Bayit Shlishi, which he thought might be a downer to people hiding in bomb shelters. But then it shows a Moshe Dayan who's kind of come back to himself a few weeks later and says, Syria better understand that the road from Damascus to Tel Aviv is also the road from Tel Aviv to Damascus. You know, so it describes all the wars, although obviously not in the detail that Michael Oren gives to the Six-Day War. There's books about each one of those things. No, but it goes into all of that. It's hard for me to give a percentage, but it definitely includes all the wars. It talks about all of the political stuff, you know, the rise and the fall of the Labor Party, Menachem Begin's gradual entering into the center of politics after 29 years in the political desert. It talks before the state about the underground and the battles between the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi, and why they were all different and what they disagreed about. And then, of course, the battles between the three of them on the one hand and the British on the other. It talks throughout, by the way, a theme that I think a lot of the books don't go into. This was really written... I wanted to speak in a certain kind of a way, especially to an American Jewish audience, or at least an American audience. Actually, the book is probably going to come out in Russian now, it looks like. And, you know, Putin asked for it, and it's the least I could do since, you know. But, you know, it's just, he's become such a good friend in so many ways. But, no, it's probably going to come out in Russian. And one of the things that actually has, it just can't be just translated. Like, it actually has to be. There's a lot in there about American Judaism, for example. I probably just have to get slashed. For example, one of the things I want people to understand is that this battle between Israel and American Jews is not a new thing. It starts in 1950, 51, when the head of the American Jewish Committee, which was then the grand dame of all American Jewish organizations, Jacob Blaustein, has a huge battle with David Ben-Gurion. And he says to Ben-Gurion, it's a very simple thing. You ever again come to this country and say to American Jews that they should make Aliyah, or you ever again say publicly that the center of the Jewish world in Israel, it's over. You will get no political support, and you will get no financial support. And David Ben-Gurion, the big fighter who won the war in 48, says, okay. And he sticks to it. And then Blaustein reads a very long speech, which we do quote in the book, in which he explains why American Jews are not so enthusiastic about Israel. And he says, almost verbatim, it's not quite it, but if you look in the book, I don't really care if you look in the book, just buy it. But in any event, kidding. Right? But what he says very quickly is, this is not a great idea, this Jewish state thing. It is going to upset the apple cart for American Jews who are just starting to feel at home. But there are hundreds of thousands of displaced persons who are Jews in Europe, and that's the best solution. Which is his way of saying, we don't want them here. So we will support the creation of a Jewish state, because if we don't, those poor, uneducated Jews are going to end up in America, and we don't need that in the 1950s when we've just started moving out to suburbia. I mean that really very seriously. We've actually moved out. Our grandparents were living in the Lower East Side, right? Our parents were living in Brooklyn, and we're living in Westchester. And we don't need hundreds of thousands of Jews coming in and complicating this. And he says it unabashedly. It's on the website of the American Jewish Committee. Ad Hayom Hazeh. Now, that's complicated. Or after the 73 war, right? I mean, Israeli Jews are literally brokenhearted. And I said before, I think we're still actually brokenhearted in many ways, but we're brokenhearted. I mean, 67, 6 days, 600-something kids, and you triple your size. 73, 3 weeks, 3,000 kids, and you claw your way back right to where you started. Except for the fact that you're not dead. You have nothing to show for 3,000 lives. Not entirely true, by the way, because no standing Arab army ever again attacked Israel. Which is one way of thinking about the Yom Kippur War in a way that makes it not a complete and utter catastrophe. But then, meanwhile, back in the ranch in America, what does one of the leaders of American Judaism say as the end of the 73 war? They say, it will be a pleasure to deal with a lesser Israel. Meaning, they were kind of full of themselves between 67 and 73. We didn't like it so much. Now, it's going to be different. This is a very complicated relationship, the relationship between Israel and North American Jewry. And I try to show all the way from the very, very, very beginning until now that it's had, like all relationships, its rises and its falls, but the tension goes back all the time. The UN vote, 2334, just a couple of weeks ago, is as old as news can possibly be. 75 is the Zionism is racism. But just a few weeks after the vote in 1947, a few weeks after, the United States State Department wants to bring the vote back to the General Assembly for a new vote. And you say, oh my God, the State Department now is so anti-Israel. You know, was that before Hillary was Secretary of State or after? Hello? It's since 1947. The State Department had the amazing accomplishment of being anti-Israel before there was Israel. It's an accomplishment of sorts. So it's about the politics. It's about the relationship with American Jews. It's about the rise of the Likud. It's, by the way, it's about the rise of the Mizrahim. It's a story that we never tell, and it's very hard. This is, by the way, it's a very hard thing. How do you do this? You start out the book and you say, "I want to write these scales." First of all, you know that Ashkenazi Jews are a minority of the Jews in Israel now. Not a small minority, it's still 48, 49 something percent, but we are a minority of the Jews in Israel. Those of us in this room are Ashkenazim, and that's the vast majority of us. And the story of the Mizrahim needs to be told in large measure, first of all, because they're most of the country that's Jewish. Number two, because it's the Mizrahim that sweep Begin into power in 1977 and therefore change Israeli politics forever and ever and ever. Because you can't understand Israeli politics if you don't understand Aryeh Deri, and you can't understand Israeli politics if you don't understand Harav Avadia Yosef. And you need to understand Aryeh Deri saying Ben-Gurion was not a Zionist. We're Zionists. And understand why he really meant that. Now, but the problem is if you want to write that story, it's hard because when you start writing the story unfolds in Europe. And all the players are European Ashkenazim. So just in terms of a challenge of writing, how do you tell a story when all the characters you introduce at the beginning of the story and for the first good chunk of the story are all Ashkenazim, European, elites, etc., and it's only those people who flee North Africa and Yemen and Iraq and Iran who sort of come belait brera in the 50s, mostly in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s, and then some of them in the late 50s as well. How do you tell the story in which they're not an afterthought? And I worked really, really hard to try to be both accurate chronologically, but to make it clear that this isn't, by the way, an Ashkenazi story, but we should really be nice to them, so let's say something about them as well. Because that's the wrong story of Israel. And both the great successes of Israel in accommodating Aliyah, but also the great failures. The Ma'abarot, not a great story. And places like Yerucham and Sderot were just Ma'abarot. Most people don't know that, but you know, Sderot didn't start out as a nothing little town. It started out as a Ma'abara, where they dumped the people that they didn't have any place else to put. And you talk to people in Sderot today when the missiles are flying over, they'll just say, the name's changed, but no, it's exactly the same thing. That's part of Israel's story. Anita Shapira, who I think is not celebrating the appearance of another English volume about the history of Israel, but Ma'ala Asot, she's Israel's finest historian without question. And I think she makes a fascinating point. She argues that the beginning of the end of the kibbutz movement is when the kibbutzim decided that they didn't want immigrants. They wanted the Yeshuv people. They wanted those people who'd gotten rid of the British. The people that came, Nitzolei Shoah, these weak people with numbers on their arm. Yes, of course, there were some kibbutzim that are made up mostly of those people, or largely, Lochamia Geta'ot and many, many others. But your typical kibbutz, your secular kibbutz in the Galil thought, we have enough people. And she argues, I think, very compellingly that that was the beginning of the end of the kibbutzim. Because when you separated yourself from the immigration narrative, you fundamentally divorced yourself from the forward progress of the Jewish state. Well, could be right, could be wrong. I think it's a fascinating theory, so I include it. So it's a very long-winded answer that doesn't focus nearly exclusively on those other kinds of issues, but you try. And of course, by the way, Alex said, concise, only 560 pages. That I'm going to actually say, in all fairness, A lot of that stuff is the appendices and glossaries and stuff at the end. The actual story itself, I forget, is like 360, 400, something like that. And it just, you breeze through it. It's like it's like Harry Potter, I'm telling you. In any event, one or two others, and then we'll, yes, please. Well, okay. Okay.
What can you say about that?
Okay, it's a very good point. First of all, it's important to separate the question of whether or not there's been a rapprochement, which I personally think there has been, but more on that in a second, with the fact that the quality of Israeli education is declining all over the place. I mean, that's just clear. I mean, it's got nothing to do necessarily with the rapprochement, not the rapprochement, but it's true in the Dati Leumi schools, it's true in the you know, the Mamlachti schools. It's just true everywhere. The quality of Israeli public education is decreasing everywhere. I'm saying, okay, so my point is that part of the reason people aren't learning those things is just because the quality of the education has decreased. I have to say, though, by the way, they're learning more than you think. When I can just tell you, when I do a thing with college kids, with army kids, whatever, now, do they know the ins and the outs of Hamatmid? No. Do they know Magash HaKesef? Absolutely. They do. They do. I did a thing on Yom Kippur this year with a bunch of secular kids, and when I did Magash HaKesef, like, yeah, okay, let's go on. No, it's because it's on the Bagrut, actually. That's why it's on. I'm not saying that's a noble. That's a noble thing. Halavai, they took something in on Yom HaZikaron, but it's not. It's because of the Bagrut. But look, I think your point is very well taken. People know less text than they used to. When I was a kid in seventh grade in the United States of America, I had to memorize the Gettysburg Address. Well, a stand up in class. I remember the same week we had in social studies do that, and in Hebrew we had to do Adon Olam. You know, the whole thing. I thought, okay, whatever. You know, one of them I knew how to sing to myself, so I was okay. One of them I was really kind of, But I don't think anybody memorizes the Gettysburg Address anymore. I think there's a whole commitment to memorization, which is a thing of the past. That's a whole other conversation about the direction that Western education in general has taken, which is, you know, a very important issue, but not specific to here. I think where you see the rapprochement is not in the curriculum of the public schools, whether they are secular or religious, because that's politics. It's Misrad HaChinuch. Where you see the rapprochement is the waiting list of thousands of kids to get into Mechinot Kedam Tzvayot, for which they're going to get no army credit and no university credit, and their parents are going to pay good money. That's a rapprochement. When a kid says, I'm going to get out of the army if I only do 3 years, a boy, I'm going to get out of the army, not at 21, but at 22, I'm going to go to this thing. And I got to tell you, two of our kids did that kind of stuff. One in particular did a kind of a classic Mechinot Kedam Tzvayot. He told this amazing story, which I'm not going to go into now, but about once sitting with a kid who had literally never, ever, 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 ever opened up a mishnah in his life. And what happened when the Gemara teacher was asking him to think of questions about a certain sugya. And the story doesn't matter right now, except I have to say that the courageous one in that story with the Gemara teacher, my son, and the other kid was the other kid. To be 18 years old and to put yourself in a situation where it's obvious you don't know anything, 18-year-olds don't like that. I mean, we don't like that so much, but 18-year-olds especially don't like that. But the truth is, and you talk to people like Micha Goodman or others, Erez Eshel and many other people running these things, there's just not enough spaces in this country for that. You can talk about Batei Prat, which are these homes that are like public places that are set up in Tel Aviv and elsewhere for kids that have graduated from the Mechinot once they're in university to just go periodically and do some learning, not yeshiva-ish learning, but Jewish text learning. This past Yom Kippur, we spent in Chispin, which we call in the Golan. Kerry calls Israel occupied Syria, probably, but nonetheless, we spent it in Chispin. Less than a week before Yom Kippur, somebody called us up at Shalem and said, we're running a program for like 75 completely secular kids. But I mean, Oiska secular, right? USDA choice secular. And he said, they want to do something on Yom Kippur that's meaningful. They aren't, everybody understands here, in America, you have to explain this. Here you don't. They're not going in a shul. They're not going for Kol Nidre, they're not going to Ne'ilah, they're not going in a shul. But their friends are going to the beach, and they don't want to go to the beach. They want something to do. Will you, Shalem, send 4 or 5 faculty people up and just teach? There's a yeshiva tichonit, there's a shul in the yeshuv, you can run back and forth to do your davening, is whatever you want. But, so a bunch of us went. And, first of all, it's just fascinating. You stand around there in Friday, and whatever night it was, Kol Nidre, in a circle, like 65, 70 people in a circle, and they all sing Kol Nidre together in what is by far the least compelling Kol Nidre you've ever heard in your life. And yet, then you say to yourself, 70 secular kids knew Kol Nidre and wanted to sing Kol Nidre. I promise you, their parents were not at Chispin singing Kol Nidre. And then during the day, some fasted, some didn't fast, some slept all the day, some went to Shiurim, but we taught Sugyot, we taught poetry, we taught this, we taught that. And we made it clear that Yom Kippur can be a day about just sort of self-examination, which is exactly what Lehit Palel actually means. And I think for the vast majority of them, and for me too, I have to say, it was a very different kind of Yom Kippur. But to see 65, 70 kids in Chispin who just don't want to be in a shul and don't want to be at the beach, that didn't happen 20 years ago. And Elul didn't happen 40 years ago. And a lot of the things that we take for granted all over this country weren't happening. I think the rapprochement is happening once kids are no longer in the grips of Misrad HaChinuch. Misrad HaChinuch politicizes education by definition. So you throw in a sugya, merits is going to go crazy. You take out a sugya, people are going to burn tires in the streets. You really can't look at the schools tragically. Someday, one day, we'll have a government that's stable enough and a government that has a vision that somebody will be able to put something in place. But right now, I think the place to look is what's happening when it's not in the control of somebody else. Is it to say that every single person working in the musachim in the Ezor Tasiya of Talpiot is running home from the musach and chapping a Mishnah shiur someplace? I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that there is an increasing number of kids who want to be part of the conversation. Paul Cowan of Blessed Memory wrote a book which he called Orphan in History. And I think what they don't want to be is orphans in history. They don't necessarily want to be from, that's totally their right. They just want to come from something and be working towards something. And I think they've also understood, and then we'll take one quick other question and we'll wrap it up. I think what they've understood is that because this conflict, and again, I try not to make it a big deal, but there's a lot of conflict in the book because there's a lot of conflict, right? Because it's not going to go away, the more educated you are, then therefore likely the more affluent you are, the easier it is for you to get the hell out of here. So if you're going to stay, you got to have a reason. It's very hard to actually write that reason down in two or three sentences without saying something about the substance of what the Jewish people has to say. They understand that, whether they articulate that or not, they understand that. By the way, another little piece, just apropos of the Mizrachim, there's a guy named Buzaglo, I forget his first name, but we talk about his stuff in the book too a little bit. He makes a fascinating argument about the difference between Ashkenazi religiosity and Mizrahi religiosity. Ashkenazim are expected to obey their Rav. I mean, your Rav gives a psak, you do what you do, or you lie, right? But you do one of those two things, right? He says Mizrahim don't work that way. Mizrahim, he argues, and he's Mizrahi, are expected to show reverence for their Rav. He doesn't expect you to obey him, and you don't necessarily. In other words, in an Ashkenazi shul, in a frum shul here in the German colony, it's ridiculous to go to shul on Shabbat morning and then to say out loud, I'm going to the beach, anybody want to ride? But not in a Mizrahi shul. You went to shul, you showed kavod to the tradition, you showed kavod to your Rav. He doesn't want you to go in the car, that's not the question. But there's a different kind of an orientation. Ironically, that kind of Mizrahi orientation to religion makes it possible for Ashkenazi kids to get back into the conversation without thinking that in order to be consistent, they then got to buy two pairs of tefillin, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. In other words, ironically, I argue very quickly, but it's like an afterthought in the book, but it's still in there, that ironically, the influence of people like Aryeh Deri and that whole crowd make it possible for Ashkenazi kids to rebel against their parents and not be hyper-secular without ever considering for a moment becoming observant. And that's the way in which there's a kind of a mutual enrichment between those two communities that we often never think about. One quick thing, by the way, after the book came out, I actually asked the guy that spoke at Shalem last year. He's the head of the Census Bureau in the government or whatever. And he has a statistic for everything. You want to know how many, left-handed people who were born between 65 and 70 live on that block? He can tell you. I asked him, what percentage of marriages in Israel are between Mizrahim and Ashkenazim? His answer? How the hell should I know? We don't track that. It's not interesting. I thought that was interesting. In other words, because in America, they can tell you exactly what the percentage of interracial marriages is. Demographers can tell you in a second. He literally didn't know. He said, all I know is it's happening more and more, and it ceased to be an interesting thing. That's already a fascinating thing. So there's a lot to this story. One more quick question and one quick answer. Well, there are people in this city who are infinitely more expert on that than I am. And the book touches on it a tiny little bit in the sense, I'll just say what I know about from the book, because to talk about the subject in general, it would be kind of ludicrous. not kind of ludicrous, it would be exceedingly ludicrous. But there's a fascinating story about the relationship between Israelis and the Shoah, about Europeans. I mean, you know much more than I do. And you know, the first time that Israelis really hear about the Shoah is Eichmann. Okay, there are hundreds of thousands of survivors here, and there's an implicit agreement. You don't talk, we won't ask. Why? Because you're an embarrassment. While we were sitting here blowing up the King David Hotel, you were behind barbed wire. What the hell? Now, obviously nobody said that, right? But Tommy Lapid, Yair Lapid's father, has a story, and this is in the book, where he's working in some kibbutz when he first got here, and he is a survivor. And the people that were going through the kibbutz food line, you know, they put out their trays and they called him Soap. That was his nickname. To call a fellow Jew Soap in the years after the Shoah is a pretty loaded thing. Israelis wanted nothing to do with the survivors. By the way, we're kind of back there again. Survivors are living beneath the poverty line. There are survivors here who can't afford their medicines. I mean, it's an abomination of the worst order. You know, you can go to the mall in Ramat Aviv, and it literally looks like you're in Beverly Hills, and there's people literally 10 kilometers away from there who can't afford their medicines. I mean, it's an abomination of the worst order. But having said that, it's an interesting question. How does this play out? It plays out, the beginning is Eichmann. By the way, who's furious about Eichmann, other than Eichmann himself? The American Jews. Mi samcha, they say. He didn't do it to Israelis. He did it to Jews. And he was in Argentina. What are you doing, kidnapping somebody from Argentina and taking him to a state that didn't exist when he committed the crime? Mi samcha? It should be done in New York. Now, who we thought in New York was going to go to Argentina and kidnap Eichmann, I mean, you know, the local lodge of the B'nai B'rith with their Swiss Army knives, it's a little hard to imagine, you know. You know, I don't know, the men's side of the Hadassah thing or whatever they call them, whatever, you know, or let's all go and get Eichmann. It's a little hard to imagine how that would have worked. But leaving that aside, it's fascinating. American Jews, and by the way, the same Jacob Blaustein, who was still in power then, said that's an outrage. But it's just an interesting aside. We see the Eichmann trial as kind of an ultimate exercise of justice. The leadership of American Judaism thought, you guys don't understand what the limits of your, you don't represent world Jews. Just a bunch of people that live in the former Palestine. Do well, but don't pretend that you're the international Jewish address. But in any event, but in Israel, Eichmann begins to change things. Literally, Jews, literally, and you can watch videos of them watching it. People literally listening to the news all day long. They listened to the testimony. When Dinor faints on the stand and falls down, that picture of the policeman dragging him off was in every Israeli newspaper. And it's still very, you know, very easy to find. It changes over the course of time. Then there's the whole phenomenon, you know, of Israeli schools going back to Poland, the very controversial but still pretty widespread phenomenon. Israelis gradually come to terms with the Shoah, and they understand, by the way, Yom HaShoah is not Yom HaShoah. It's Yom HaShoah V'Gvura, right? The only way that Israelis could be convinced to make even a day for it was to put it on the anniversary of the uprising. In other words, the only thing we can talk about at the Shoah is when the people rebelled. And then people asked, why? People literally asked. I mean, it's not like as if. They asked, why did you go like sheep to the slaughter? People literally asked that. And by the way, that became a very interesting question for survivors to ask. What actually happened to us there? And for me, the most compelling answer, which we don't talk about in the book, is it's like the upending of gravity. If gravity were suddenly suspended at this moment, none of us would have any idea how to react, because none of the instincts of put this here, put, you don't know how to react. You're in Germany. It's Berlin. Everybody you know is a professor or a doctor or a lawyer or a musician or a this or a that, and all of a sudden, the neighbors that you've lived next to for 20 years are laughing as the Nazis throw your pianos and stuff out the window and put you in trucks. I mean, how do you begin to know how to react to that? But Israelis do, after Eichmann's the turning point. Eichmann is the turning point, to the point that, of course, in terms of the official Israeli narrative now, the official Israeli narrative is, of course, very, very deferential to the survivors of the Shoah, to the point that the vast majority, or not the vast, but the majority of Jews who stand at attention during the siren now are Mizrahim, who weren't affected by the Shoah, mostly. So it's become a kind of a national narrative that transcends. And by the way, even though it's all repetitive and it's very predictable, and the prime minister will go to, you know, on Yom HaShoah, is it the Kotel or Yad Vashem? I forget. It's Yad Vashem, I think, on Yom HaShoah, and then Yom HaZikon is the Kotel, right? And give the same talk about how if there had been in Israel, there would not have da-da-da-da. It's either true or it's not true, but that's what every prime minister of every party says every year. It's become a liturgy, in a sense. I mean, it really has become a liturgy. That's part of our self-understanding. Now, by the way, that comes at a tremendous cost. Because as the Shoah is the paradigmatic example of Jewish victimization, victims typically don't take risks. So the more you think of yourself fundamentally as a person formed by, shaped by, in the shadow of the Shoah, then it's very hard to know. Lieberman, when he was in the Knesset, I don't know where his office looks now, but when I was once in his office in the Knesset, there was but one picture on his wall. The boy in the Warsaw Ghetto. It's the only thing on his wall. That tells you a tremendous amount. And if that's how you see the world, and I'm not criticizing him, God forbid, I'm not criticizing him. But if that's how you see the world, that's going to say something about what kind of risks you take for what kind of accommodation. Whereas there's other members of Knesset. What's his name? It'll come to me in a minute. American Jewish leader. Malcolm Hohnlein, who has on his office the pictures of the jets over Auschwitz, the F-15s over Auschwitz. Both are pictures having to do with the Shoah. Those are very different images of the existential condition of the Jew, which is, I think, a good way of wrapping up, which is to say, I think that the story of Israel is the story of the Jewish people wrestling with the question of what is and what should be the existential condition of the Jew. I think that's what makes this country a fascinating place. What makes the Knesset a raucousy place is that it's just the continuation of the conversation that was being had in the Zionist idea. But then statehood happened, and instead of having it in articles, we have it in the Knesset. But it's still the same battle. The battle between Meretz and Shas, at the end of the day, is not only about power. It's about what should the Jewish people look like, do, believe, behave, etc., etc. What should our attitude to our enemies be? Is it Jabotinsky or is it Ben-Gurion? Who was right? Jabotinsky, by the way, was right. But it doesn't matter. No, what are you going to do? You can't help it, right? You know what Jabotinsky called Ben-Gurion, by the way? He called Ben-Gurion a vegetarian. Ben-Gurion was not a vegetarian. But he called these people that believed that if you brought hygiene to the Middle East, that they would embrace you. That's what they thought. They literally thought that. And Jabotinsky said, first of all, you're like vegetarians. You know, you live in some sort of little, back then, vegetarian was unusual. And then he said, you're actually also racists. Because if you think their love of the land is any less powerful than your love of the land, would you give up wanting to come back to the land because somebody gave you pipes? Or hygiene in a medical clinic? You wouldn't. Your love for the land goes far deeper than this. So does theirs, said Jabotinsky. So in this pamphlet called The Iron Wall, he said, therefore, if you want to stay, you need an iron wall. They have to know that every time they attack you, they are going to hit an iron wall. And I think the question is, as long as that's the case, which I think it still is, why do you want to stay? What's happening here that can't happen anywhere else? What's the conversation? What's the yearning? What's the wondering here that's really taking place? That, I think, is the fascinating central question of the Jewish people returning to its ancestral homeland and building the state. That's the question that I hope resides at the heart of the book. And I thank you for coming and sharing the evening.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.